time for business and finance. And my guest this week is Emily Stewart. She's a finance reporter for the ABC. You might also know her as Sensible Emily from the Pineapple Project podcast. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you have a story coming out tomorrow, so we have a bit of a scoop here about how to choose a financial planner in a post-banking Royal Commission environment. How did it come about?
Well, we've got a new personal finance project at the ABC where we're asking for people to write into us with their questions. So they can do that at abc.net.au/money. And we've had a lot of people writing in asking about how to choose a financial planner, because with the revelations from the Royal Commission, people are really worried about getting trusted advice, you know, to do with managing their money, which is understandable. And so people are a bit concerned about what's the difference between a planner and an accountant, and how do I find someone that's independent or might be looking out for my needs.
Why is it so difficult to figure out which financial planner to choose? One that's, you know, doesn't have a vested interest or an agenda to essentially rip you off?
Well, the industry is very opaque, I've found. So sort of I've found that there's three levels basically of independence, or the type of advisor. There's the bank-owned advisors, and we saw a lot of scandal in the Royal Commission around fees for no service and charging dead people, and also pushing their products that the bank or the financial institution they work for creates. And so that's been some of the issues around those advisors, and they're about 45% of advisors of the whole industry. Then there's independently licensed advisors, and they're typically your small businesses. But the issue there is around commissions. And while some commissions have been banned since the FOFA reforms in 2013, there's still life insurance commissions that advisors can receive. And so that's something to look out for if you're choosing one of those. And then there's the truly independent advisors, and there's only 60 around Australia, and they have to have very strict rules, which is no commission, no asset-based fees, and also no, affiliations with big financial institutions.
60.
Yes, the 60. So it's a very difficult environment when you're looking for advice. And I guess you've got to ask what sort of advice you're happy to receive, whether or not you could still go to an independently licensed planner because you're asking about super or about tax and not about life insurance products. But the real issue is that you've got to ask questions, because you can't tell just by looking at the name of the company or the credentials of the person.
Wow. Okay, on to another story. The privately owned aged care provider Bupa has been taken to court by the ACCC. What are they alleging?
So the ACCC says that Bupa's been making false and misleading claims about the services it provides at about 21 of its aged care homes. And it's basically charging a fee for extra services that it didn't provide. And that's been going on for about 10 years, since 2007. What's interesting, in ACCC said that Bupa actually self-reported to them. And that's why this whole case has now come about, and it's going to be heard in the federal court.
That is interesting. Mm. Self-reported. Is that common? I don't imagine it is.
No, but
putting your hand up.
No.
Yeah, we've done this.
But anyway, that's how it's happened.
And how much money are we talking about here?
Well, it's thousands of dollars per year for these extra services. And the sort of services were aircon in bedrooms, hot breakfasts, a big talking book library, covered outdoor areas. So people were paying all this extra money for these services, you know, to make it more of a luxury aged care facility, but they weren't actually available when they got there.
How many residents actually live in these Bupa-operated facilities?
Bupa's quite big, and it's got about 70 aged care facilities around Australia, and so it's about 6,700 people that live in those aged care facilities. It's only 21 of those where these charges are about, but, yeah, it's a lot of people.
But 21's still quite significant,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
All right, so let's move on to another story, and this one's quite interesting. What exactly is Afterpay?
So Afterpay, you've probably heard about Shop Now, Pay Later, and basically it allows customers to receive their goods before they make a payment. And so they make payments of installments, fortnightly installments. It's come under quite a lot of criticism for sort of encouraging consumers to be purchasing items that they might not necessarily be able to afford.
Why has it become so popular?
Well, it's I think customers like having access to products that they can't necessarily afford or at that stage. So it's particularly popular with young people. And it's an Australian company. It's listed and it's gone into the US last year, which is obviously a huge market to go into. It's now reached $6 billion. And the company says that it's done better than expected with its performance. It's got millions. It's got a million customers in 10 months in the US. What was really interesting here was that they say that US millennials have an aversion to debt because of the whole issue around student debt. And they said that that's actually helped them because, strangely, Afterpay is not considered a form of credit under law because interest isn't charged. They do charge late fees, and that's where they do get quite a bit of money. But because interest isn't charged, they think that they're not a credit provider. And so they think that this aversion to debt in the US has actually helped them. So I think that's quite curious.
It is quite curious. And it's really a fascinating business model. So they essentially rely on largely millennials, because young people like this quite a lot, not paying in time. And is there a lot of people who do that?
Yeah, I think a significant amount. I understand that they have capped their fees because they were coming under a lot of criticism about that. But yes, a significant amount would be from either retailer fees because they would pay to access this facility. And then they'd also get fees, late fees from all those people that, you know, couldn't come up with the money after, you know, a few weeks.
I wonder if they're helpfully not reminding people.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not a user, so I wouldn't know.
No. Paying for what you can afford, living within your means. Isn't that sort of the political term for it?
Yeah, and it's probably a bit more sensible, so I've got to stay true to my name.
I was about to make the sensible joke, but you made it for me first. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, PK.
Emily Stewart is a finance reporter for the ABC, and of course you also know her as Sensible Emily from the Pineapple Project podcast. This is RN Drive. Patricia Carvelis with you. It's coming up to news time at 7.